Hello there and welcome to Culture Wars with me, Andrew Doyle. Today I am delighted to welcome Giles Fraser. Giles is a writer, a polemicist, he's a parish priest in Elephant and Castle, South London. He's written for The Guardian and he also writes for Unheard, where he also has a podcast called Confessions. He's a former supporter of Jeremy Corbyn, but he ended up voting for the Conservatives in the last general election, largely because of Brexit. Up until 2011, he was the Canon Chancellor of St. Paul's Cathedral. He resigned in the aftermath of the Occupy movement, which is something we talk about in the show. Here's my conversation with Giles. Hope you enjoy it as much as I do. I haven't had any priests on the podcast so far, apart from James Dreyfuss, who played a priest on TV, which I don't think counts. You're an authentic celebrity priest, but you're at the core of a community, really, as a priest. I mean, I know when I grew up, my church, my priest was very important to me. And I think it is in that community a very important thing. How do you manage during a period like ours where we have COVID, obviously? I mean, this must completely make the idea of communion impossible, or at least very, very difficult.
I mean, it has to be said, even before then, there are some parts of the world where community is a really hard thing to establish. And this part of the Elephant and Castle is a place where there's an enormous amount of social churn. People come and go and come and go all the time. And it's a pace people pass through. If I sit quietly in my church where I am now, sit really quietly, you can hear the Northern Line rumbling underneath you. And you just get this sense that people are coming and going, come and go. And it's hard for community to develop when there's people come and go, come and go. But there is a sort of nub of community around here. And I mean, COVID has made it really, really difficult.
What have you done? Have you been carrying out mass over Zoom and things like
Zoom,
that?
Yeah. There's been some advantages with that. You know, we've reached people who we haven't been able to get into church for a while because mm-hmm. they've been poorly. So actually those people who, elderly and poorly, who haven't left home, they've actually felt more included than before. But by and large, you know, it's not the same. I mean, we've spent so much time on Zoom. Just, it's very hard. I mean, Christianity is a flesh and blood business. It's an incarnational business. And it isn't so effective, emotionally effective, spiritually effective over Zoom. Just, it isn't the same.
I think that's right.
I think that's particularly true for Catholic churches. I mean, those churches that are word-based, those more Protestant churches, where it's just about, you know, that the focus is on the teaching, then, you know, maybe that survives better on Zoom. But those that are more about the Eucharist and things like that, that's much more difficult to do on Zoom. And I've struggled a lot about how that happened. That's why we're open. I mean, despite COVID, we are still open and we are still, I'm still celebrating the Eucharist and distributing the bread.
So I want to take you back a bit because I want to talk through your background so that people understand, because you're in a kind of unique position insofar as you're a priest with your own parish and all the rest of it, but you also write political and cultural commentary. And you're very involved politically, which is unusual, I think, for someone in your position. Well, let's go back. How did it start for you? Because I know that you were a member of the SWP early in life.
When I was a kid, yeah. I mean, when I was at university. So I'm posh public school boy. Well, at least I went to a posh public school, though my mother's working class, my father is in the Air Force, and both of them, in all sorts of ways, rootless. My mum ran away from home because it was not a place she wanted to be. My dad, in a way, the war separated him from his Jewish roots and his Jewish community, and they sort of met each other without any sort of hinterland, really. Mm-hmm. And because in the RAF, they moved around all over the place. So my mum and dad decided, partly because of my mum's working class aspiration, they were going to be sent to a really posh school. So I went to a posh school without coming from a posh background. I went to school with people who had grouse moors, but I come from somewhere completely different.
I see. Yeah.
So when I went to university, I had, you know, you're still a child when you go to university. I had that sort of hard left reaction to public school that's a fairly common one. But also, you know, it has a sort of I want to go and change the world type of feeling to it. So the SWP was, for a while, you know, how that expressed itself.
And how active were you in the party?
Not that active. I was just gobby.
Okay.
That's how I would have described myself. And that's what I would have been known for. But I went to Newcastle University, and being up in the Northeast, after a while, it just felt like a pose, my sort of hard leftism. There's still sort of elements of it. I'm still touched by some of it. Suspicion of capitalism and what capitalism can do. That stayed with me. But when the sort of revolutionary fervour Goodness yes. gracious me. I mean, we were so mad. I mean, the first time I got to vote, I voted for Mrs. Thatcher because we all sort of got together in the students' union, as it were. And we all decided that, you know, the only way that this country was going to get better if there was a revolution, and the best way to bring about a revolution was we're going to all vote for the worst thing possible, which would obviously, that was what was going to bring about the revolution. So Thatcher was, a whole load of the SWP, no, none of that Labour Party progressive nonsense, you know. The kingdom was not going to arrive through that.
You wanted to destroy everything in order to rebuild it.
Almost the exact polar opposite of what I believe now.
That's quite a journey.
I realised soon that this was opposed. This was student politics. This was right. even pre-student politics. This was like posh boy trying to rebel politics.
But I am interested in that dual track of priest and polemicist because, you know, both of those are aspirational. Both of those are about identifying what's wrong with society and trying to change it. And, you know, there's a positive drive and a similar drive behind them. Which came first? Which one did you fall into first?
Oh, the politics came first. Absolutely the politics. Right. I was an atheist when I went to university. I mean, not even an atheist with angry atheist. It was just like I hadn't really thought about it and didn't care. But if you asked me, I'd probably say I was an atheist. Mm-hmm. There isn't much religion in my background apart from my, and this is, I should have just written a book about this, about my great-grandfather's brother who was a rabbi in Liverpool. But there isn't much religion in my family, really.
So how did that happen? How did you suddenly find God?
That was, in a way, the collapse of the SWP type of thinking. I was doing philosophy at uni, and I started doing philosophy of religion, which was just one of the course options that I did. And I found this fascinating, and I found particularly some of the criticisms of religion fascinating. Nietzsche, who I went on to write my PhD on, I was fascinated by this. And in a way, people like Nietzsche, Kierkegaard, others, but Nietzsche particularly, sort of laid into religion in such a way that I knew I had to take it seriously. I mean, it was like, well, you know, what's getting this guy so riled up?
Yes.
And so in a strange way, someone like Nietzsche made me take religion seriously. And for a long time, people used to say about me, Giles has got a very strange hobby almost. It's sort of like, I didn't used to go to church. And, you know, I was quite a lad when I was younger, but I was fascinated by Christianity, particularly Christianity. Mm-hmm. And it took a while for that fascination and that sort of private reading and to sort of break out into self-description. But that's what happened. And I suppose quite a lot of the I want to change the world energy that was there in the SWP got decanted into Christianity.
You see, all of that makes a lot of sense to me because I see them as comparable. But the belief in God element, going from atheism to that, was it a kind of revelatory? I mean, I'm thinking of in Peter Hitchens' book, The Rage Against God, where he describes his, you know, same journey going from atheism to devout Christianity. And he mentions looking at a painting, this painting, The Last Judgment, and seeing the damned and almost reasoning himself into a belief in God because he sees himself as one of the damned in this painting. And, well, I'd better do something about it then. Not so much a kind of sudden conversion on the road to Damascus, not that kind of struck by God thing, but rather reasoning your way into faith, which struck me as contradictory, actually. But what do you think?
So not quite like that for me. So for me, I was very, very taken with the sort of poetic, the sort of things that were made possible by seeing the world from a religious point of view. But if you ask me about the God question, did I believe that God exists? I mean, early on, I'd have said no. And then I just didn't know how to answer the question. I didn't even know what sort of question it was. I know this might sound stupid to people, but I didn't even know really what sort of question it was. So I suppose I said to myself, I mean, the technical philosophical bit is very much under the influence of Wittgenstein and a whole load of sort of Wittgensteinian philosophers. I allowed myself to bracket that question out. So just put that question, the God exist question, put that question in the bracket and see what else I can do with all of this.
Yes.
Okay. And so I was fascinated by it. And I started, I suppose, to see the world from a religious point of view, even though if you'd have returned again and again to the does God exist question, I'd go, that's a difficult one.
Well, it is a difficult one. It's probably the most difficult question.
And of course, if you actually look at some of the great theologians, Aquinas, for instance, describes theology as faith seeking understanding. So, yes. You know, you're in search of trying to understand this. That's what the journey is. I mean, I still haven't sorted out what's in the bracket.
I'm very interested in this because for me, the existence of God was always a given because as a child, I was raised to pray every night and believe that there was this entity there looking out for me, which is why I quite like reading the sort of the skeptics about God, people like Dawkins and Grayling, because even though their rationality appeals to me, there's something in my head I cannot get rid of, which is the existence of a God, which is just a given, as far as I can see.
I never believed in the God that they don't believe in.
Okay.
So that sort of bounces off me completely. They're attacking something that I've never been there in the way that they presume I have to be.
Right.
I mean, there's a technical and complicated relationship between God and existence. And it's complicated in very orthodox theology. This is not sort of like obscure, lefty, sort of liberal theology. I mean, for example, Aquinas again says, if you had to do a sort of a strange sort of accountancy of all of the sorts of things that existed in the universe, tables and chairs and people and clouds and whatever there is, and you made a long list of what was in the universe, God would not be on that list.
Mm.
That's not what God is, not a thing in the world. Now, that is another way of saying that God doesn't exist.
I see.
But the question really is, what sort of existence does God have? I believe in God. I absolutely passionately, my life is dedicated to it. I believe in God. But I don't think God has the same existence as this can of Coke or this table, you know.
Right.
And the words that we use like existence usually apply to things like that. You know, would you say that numbers exist? Well, that's a complicated business, really.
So in a sense, is it true what Roger Scruton says in his book, England and Elegy? He talks about there really wasn't a tradition of, specifically talking about the Church of England, and he says there wasn't really a tradition of God belief among the priests. A lot of the time, they didn't even have to believe in God. It wasn't about that. It was about tradition.
Well, I do believe in God. So look, I've been very, very clear about this. I absolutely do believe in God. I've been talking quite specifically about the question of existence. Okay, this is a question about what are we saying about a thing when we say it exists? Okay, we have so collapsed a word like existence into empirical existence. That's what people think you mean when you talk about exists. Now, of course, I think God exists. I mean, I do think God exists, but I really don't think God exists in the same way that things exist.
I see.
So that's the nub of it. So then you have to get into quite a complicated discussion about ontology, about what sort of existence God has. Have you talked a lot about ontology on your podcast?
And loads. Rarely talk about anything else. You're listening to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle. If you're enjoying the podcast, please make sure you subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can subscribe to the podcast on all the major apps, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, and more. And if your provider allows you to, then why not give Culture Wars a rating and a review while you're there? It would really help other listeners to find us. Now, back to the show. I'm very interested in the way of how politics can impact on Christianity and to what extent Christianity is in itself political. I mean, you mentioned your still residual mistrust of capitalism dating right back to your SWP days. It always struck me in the Bible that an opposition to capitalism is kind of inbuilt in the teaching of Christ. You know, one of the things he unambiguously says is if you're rich, give your money away. There isn't really much wriggle room there. And yet when I hear the sort of very evangelical right-wing preachers talking about send me money, get rich for Christ, I find it very difficult to reconcile that just in terms of pure exegesis. Like, how do you reconcile that with the words of the Bible?
No idea. But I think that criticism goes deeper than the question of poverty and wealth, actually. I mean, though that's obviously important. And of course, the big proviso here is capitalism is a word that only really comes to existence in whatever, the 18th century or wherever you want to put it. But I mean, but with all those provisos, I think, and this is where, you know, the Marxist thing in me is alive and well, is that one of the things that Marxism and particularly Judaism share is a hostility to reification, in making something into a thing. So, you know, God gets made into a thing and the golden calf. Moses goes up the mountain and his brother's making a sort of golden model of God. Everybody sort of like worships. This is the number one thought crime of the Hebrew scriptures, is to worship God as a sort of thing. Now, that whole analysis is also used by many, especially Frankfurt School type Marxists, as the problem with capitalism. It turns people into things. It turns us into sort of functionary cogs in a machine, and it's a sort of dehumanizing aspect. I definitely think that. So that my criticism of capitalism is not just that it's not good at distributing its successes, and it is successful in terms of wealth generation.
Yeah.
It's not just that. It's also that it there is a dehumanizing element to what capitalism does to people. However, apparently right-wing I get, I will always have that.
That to me is very interesting, is that to what extent, at a time of such incredible political tribalism, Christianity can be a force for unity insofar as I hear capitalists claiming Jesus as their own. I hear socialists saying Jesus was a socialist. But that to me is to use the Bible to further the division. Is it possible that the ministry of Christ could be a unifying thing politically, I mean?
Well, I mean, it only unifies left and right when you sort of realize there are things that are a bit more important than left and right. Mm-hmm. You know, and our culture wars, our pathetic, silly, stupid culture wars, which, I'm involved in too, I suppose.
Well, we can't not be, can we, at the moment? That's the problem. Not,
you can still think they're foolish. And
As I do.
I think the one place where I find that stuff doesn't really have a purchase is in church. And I love mm-hmm. the fact that my church has people from really broad across the political spectrum. I mean, you know, we have sort of alt-right-ish type of people sitting the next door pew to someone with their Corbyn badge on. And I really like that. I mean, I think that's really, and you know, and all shades in between. And what unites them is much bigger than what divides them.
By alt-right, I presume you're meaning sort of identity politics-based right-wing, but not white nationalist, which is how it's come to mean.
No. That's what I meant.
I'm just clarifying that because the word has become so ambiguous now. I think it's difficult to use the phrase without having the connotations of white nationalism now. That's the only reason I mention it.
No, I mean, this is black majority church, so that has no place here. But the politics of the place are very diverse. And yet, when we're in church, it doesn't matter. You know, there's more important things to talk about.
I think that's something that the whole, I mean, the culture wars thing, which I've got dragged into as well. One of the positives of this, I think, is that I had, for many years, a kind of prejudice because everyone I knew was on the left or certainly self-identified as being on the left. And I didn't really know right-wing people. And because I've been so alienated by a lot of supposedly left-wing people now, and I've got to know a lot of conservatives, and I've realized a lot of them are just lovely human beings with good intentions as well. So all of my prejudice have been exploded. And now I can see that actually left and right is sort of meaningless. It's about humanity and it's about empathy and it's about compassion. All of the things that I do associate with Christianity.
I do think that's true. And you and I have been on a similar journey, I suspect. I mean, I don't know what precipitated yours, but mine, you know, until fairly recently, I was still card-carrying lefty in the sort of quasi-Marxist tradition, not identity politics, more Tony Benny type of stuff.
Yes.
And, I mean, Ben was a hero of mine and something of a sort of mentor, really. I think Brexit probably is what did it. I was always through that tradition. I was a Eurosceptic, hostile to the European Union. For me, it was just a sort of businessman's club. However, I was quite shocked, actually, that I didn't really understand the left. I mean, I suppose I wouldn't have been surprised by a certain amount of internal debate, but I was really surprised by the extent to which the left went in with the Remain campaign. And then, of course, you see things when you're on, as it were, the other side of a debate. If you're the one then suddenly being accused of this, that and the other from a sort of left position, then you're sort of like, hang on. First of all, how did this happen?
Yes.
Secondly, it starts to show you some of the things that the left had traditionally done to people on the right that seem to me manifestly unfair and, again, dehumanizing, really, and the way in which, at its extreme form, some on the left find it very difficult to acknowledge the full humanity of those on the right because they see them as being beyond the pale in some way. And now I suppose I was guilty of that as well.
I think that's what's disturbing, isn't it? The dehumanization, the determination to just see these people as less than human, as monsters, as racists, as stupid, as evil, all the rest of it, rather than engaging with people's concerns.
Their views stand in for their humanity and their views are to be condemned, so they're to be condemned. Mm. Some of the worst stuff, I suppose, was all that sort of never kissed a Tory. I've always had friends from way across the political divide. And I've always thought that was way more important.
Yes.
And, you know, this whole thing becoming much more tribal, then I begin to sort of feel that my identification on the left slipped.
I mean, presumably because so many people have bought into this lazy narrative that if you voted for Brexit, you are therefore racist, xenophobic and right wing. Whereas for me, of course, to vote Brexit would signify the opposite of all of those things. But that was so commonly bought. Has that caused any problems for you in your community or anything like that? Have people mistrusted you for being such a vocal supporter of Brexit?
Yeah, I think some. I think I've had some difficult conversations. Not that many. I've had some. You know, there are some passionate Remainers here, and there's a couple of times I've had to say to them, look, I'm really sorry, but this is why I think, and please forgive me for having views that just irritate the hell out of you. I'm really, really sorry. I promise you this isn't going to come into the pulpit. You know, I can do this as an op-ed, but this has no place in church, and I don't bring it into church. You know, I'll never do that. But, you know, I'm free to write what I want to write as everybody else is. So that's a different business.
And so you don't ever bring those two together, even in the homily?
So I don't think that my views about the European Union can be, you know, directly read off from the scriptures, okay?
Right.
I'm happy to have a go to talk about the relationship of the nation state, for instance.
Yes.
The view of the state in the Hebrew scriptures, for instance. I'm happy to have having that conversation. But you can't read off your particular political position directly from... There are some things you can, you know. So, well, you talked about racism before. Absolutely no place. You know, I'd be perfectly happy to condemn racism from the pulpit.
Yes.
Perfectly happy to condemn all sorts of political views from the pulpit.
Mm.
But absolutely not something like Brexit. However, I still think there's theological things that can be said about it.
Yes.
But you have a real privilege when you preach. And I'm not going to confuse what I, as a citizen of this country, are entitled to think about and argue about down the pub or in the newspapers with what I, as a priest, get to preach.
But there is something to be said from the pulpit for not mischaracterizing those who disagree with you, not dehumanizing
people.
You know, and it's on both sides. You know, I mean, I've heard people talk about Remainers being rabid and intransigent, and actually it's on both sides, you know.
Though the truth of the matter is, with something like that, I mean, you're right, I'd be perfectly happy to condemn something like that, but the best way of doing it is not to condemn it. The best way of doing it is just to demonstrate that actually people can get on with their different views. So you don't really need to do that. You know, we've got Remainers and Leavers here in church. And this is a subject we don't often talk about.
So can I push back a bit on that? Just because when you were Canon Chancellor of St. Paul's Cathedral, you were open in your support of the Occupy movement. Does that not represent a political intervention from a religious standpoint?
I don't mind intervening politically. So I was like, I think the gospel is a political thing. And I think I don't have any problem with that. I think it has significant political valence.
Right.
And I think that the situation Occupy was, for me, a clear case of it having political valence. It just so happens that it doesn't have political valence on all of the subjects that are of political concern.
So could you tell us about that and what happened there? Because I know just from reading about your forthcoming book, which is called Chosen, that you start from this position, that you're talking about what happened with the Occupy movement and the fallout from that. Do you want to explain to anyone who's listening who doesn't know what happened there, what went on?
So it's quite simple. It was 10 years ago this year in October. People may remember the whole Occupy movement, protest against capitalism and the way in which capitalism worked. And the protest arrived originally intended to be outside the Stock Exchange next door to St. Paul's Cathedral. And the land on which the Stock Exchange exists is private land. So they were kicked off. And the Occupy movement set up camp around St. Paul's for several months. And then this was a subject of some considerable media attention during that time. And I made it clear to my colleagues that if the church decided to evict these protesters, and I'd seen some of the images of previous evictions of the Occupy movement that had been quite violent,
yes,
then I couldn't sanction that sort of violence done in the name of the church. Especially, you know,
yes,
there were banners flying out there going, what would Jesus do? And all this sort of stuff. And there's no way I could agree with people going into that crowd in police uniform with, you know, shields and batons and breaking it up.
And how did you feel being in the middle of all that? Because obviously you were presumably under pressure from the city authorities and the protest and your views on the protesters. How did you reconcile that?
Well, I mean, it proved unsustainable and I resigned. So, I mean, you know, that was, I suppose, the ultimate consequence of it. Again, you've got to be careful not to quite caricature it, because the city was more mixed about it than you might imagine.
Oh, really? Okay, I didn't realise.
And the city is a different sort of, there's the traders and all of that side, they were not that bothered by it, really. The people who were really bothered by Occupy were probably the sort of City of London Corporation and that sort of broader livery company type of side of the city. They were probably the ones that were most irritated by the mess and the sort of people peeing up the cathedral and the sort of tatty tents and all of that sort of stuff. I think it was a visceral thing that people had in reaction to it. My job at the cathedral was partly to encourage debate about the role of the city. St. Paul's had always been a place of debate. You know, there's the St. Paul's Cross, which is where debate had happened for centuries. So the idea that there was sort of public debate prompted outside St. Paul's Cathedral was exactly what I was supposed to be about.
Yes, yes.
But for me, the line in the sand was like, I could not sanction the eviction. And that's when I went.
Hi, it's Fraser Myers here. I produce Culture Wars and all of Spike's podcasts. I really hope you're enjoying the show so far. This podcast, like all of Spike's content, is free. There's no paywalls or no paid subscriptions. We rely on the support of our loyal listeners and readers like yourself to keep producing our groundbreaking podcasts, interviews, articles, essays, and more. So, if you're a regular listener to this podcast and you're wondering how best to support it, please do consider donating to Spiked, or even better, becoming a regular donor. Even £5 per month can make an enormous difference. To start your regular donation today, just go to spiked-online.com and click the red donate button in the top right corner. That's spiked-online.com and the red donate button in the top right corner. Now, back to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle.
And so why have you chosen this as the starting point for your book, which I obviously haven't read because it's not out till April? The title of the book, Chosen, Lost and Found Between Christianity and Judaism. I'm interested in that because you have a very interesting hybrid identity because obviously your wife is Jewish and your children are Jewish and you yourself are a high Anglican priest or Catholic, however you describe yourself. So talk to me about that.
I mean, I suppose what I've just said about the Occupy thing is the absolute backdrop to that. So when I resigned, didn't have a plan as to what I was going to do. And there was a job up in Liverpool that the Bishop of London encouraged me to go for. And I went up there on a cold, horrible day like today. I got off at Liverpool Lime Street and I thought, oh, God, I mean, I'm a Londoner. I mean, I felt like exile going to Liverpool. Apologies to everybody from Liverpool, but I'm like, I'm the worst sort of London-centric. It's not M25 for me. It's like, personally, if you're outside zone one and two, there's trouble.
Yeah.
So going to Liverpool is like, I don't know this place. I've got no friends here. I've got anything. And I sat outside. I always get to places really early and I had a cup of coffee and I smoked half a dozen fags. And then suddenly one thought came into my head, which was that I have one slender connection with this place, which was that my great-grandfather's brother was the rabbi, I thought, of the Prince's Road Synagogue, which is in Toxteth. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, I've got a bit of time. I'll get a taxi. I'll go up there and see what it looks like. I'll just knock about. And I went up there and knocked about. And I banged on the synagogue door. And the caretaker was there and let me in. And I said, look, I know this is really mad, but a distant relative of mine, Samuel Friedeberg, used to be the rabbi of this synagogue. I said, oh, yeah, yeah, come on in. There's a great big oil painting of him here. And I sort of sat in front of this oil painting. And I left the synagogue and sat down the side of the road. And I just lost it, cried, and was totally devastated by this. I didn't know why. I had no idea why. And I hadn't really cried or been very emotional since the whole Occupy thing. I'd really held it together. This knocked me to bits. So it took me a long time to work out what it was, but it felt like, and the story that I tell in the book is a story of my father's family that came over to this country, very Jewish, soon after Cromwell allowed Jews to come back into this country, poor, lived in Portsmouth, and slowly, slowly, slowly integrated into this country. In the end, changing the name from Friedeberg to Fraser or Frampton, different names, in response mostly to anti-Semitism. And then right at the end of this, my father gets distance from his Jewish community, leaves Golders Green when the bombs start to fall, and goes out to a prep school in Devon, in Biddeford. The connection with Judaism gets lost. And I grow up, and then I've told you the story of my conversion, you know, and I end up being a Christian priest in St. Paul's Cathedral. It's about as assimilated. All they wanted to do, my ancestors, was just be a part of this place, you know.
Yes.
My grandmother would have just loved, I mean, she was very Jewish, my grandmother, but she would have loved the fact that, you know, at St. Paul's I had all my, you know, all my kit on, and this was, it was a posh place. This is, you know, you can't get any more assimilated than a priestess.
No,
that's the top of the tree.
It really is.
And I was just like, what happened? Did someone betray something? Was something, I don't think, part of anything. Is this why I don't fit in the church? Is this part of where I'm lost? Is that what it is?
So in retrospect, then, in hindsight, that moment where you broke down, was it this realization of a fulfillment of a kind of a family ambition, but also compounded by recent events and the pressure of recent events?
No, it was just a strong sense of loss. It's like, it was a sense that, have we given up our historic faith and identity for a sort of seat at the table? There was a chief rabbi, I think it was Nathan Marcus Adler, who started to wear gaiters and going to London clubs and the Athenaeum and all this sort of stuff. And he was called by one acerbic newspaper column the captive of the English gentry or something like that, you know. And yes. I felt, have I been captured? You know, has something about me been lost and then captured? And I couldn't answer that question. I found it really difficult. And on top of this, my marriage broke up and there was like so many things. You know, I went through a period of real, real darkness. And then over the last several years, I've remarried. My wife is Israeli. My children are Jewish and Hebrew speaking. And Hebrew is what they speak at home. And I try a bit. My Hebrew is not very good, but it's, you know, keeps the Alzheimer's away trying to learn it. This is what the book's about. The book used to be called Not Chosen. And there's a really lovely thing that my mother-in-law came over from Tel Aviv and she got me to explain the book to her. I said, it's all about me not being Jewish and about the pain about not being Jewish and that sort of assimilated thing. And she goes, not chosen. She goes, my daughter's chosen you. You sort of, we've all chosen you. Our family's chosen you. You're sort of loved and wanted. How can you claim not chosen? And she said, it's the wrong title, in the way that Israelis are quite bloody direct about this, you know, wrong title.
Yes.
You know, so, and I was just like, that's just the loveliest thing anybody's ever said to me.
It's fantastic because it's also, it just shifts the emphasis to optimism.
And then suddenly the book's called Chosen, you know, so it's a sort of love story, really. But, you know, I'll always be a priest and I'll always see the world from a Christian point of view, but it's a love story to Judaism, is the book.
Maybe this is why, I mean, you and I have spoken about identity politics in the past, and you know I have a deep mistrust of it. But I think, in a sense, identity feels to be at the core of your story.
It's completely the core of my story. It's the search for home. Because perhaps of my father and my mother and how things have come, I've had a sort of very deracinated existence, away at school, moving all over the place. And so there's been a longing for something like you might call home. And I mean, like Roger Scruton stuff really resonates with me. Is it oikophilia, the sort of love of home?
Yes.
That feels terribly important to me and to my politics now. But where is home? Mm. For people like me, that's a really hard question.
People would say, though, that idea of oikophobia, as he calls it, is an essentially right-wing view.
Well, that's the thing, is it? So is the belief that there are things like home, the sort of familiar, knowing the people that you live amongst, why would that be something that was intrinsically right-wing? That used to be called something like community. It's what people used to mean by community. From the Industrial Revolution onwards, when people start to get pushed around by capitalism to move all over the place and start to break their links with where they've traditionally been,
yes,
that's what breaks that traditional idea of home and community. But I don't care what you call it, right wing, left wing.
But I think it's quite important to the discussions we're having today generally, because if you take what's just happened with the National Trust are very much pushing a kind of agenda where they are resentful of their own history and condemnatory of their own history. And the academic who's pushed this entire agenda, she wrote a book called Green Unpleasant Land, which strikes me as the embodiment of oikophobia, this fear of your own home, the fear of being connected to place. And there does seem to be within England and now, of course, in America and the 1619 Project, a genuine kind of, let's just tear down and attack our own history and pick out all the bad things and not focus on any of the good. Is that helpful to us as a society?
Terrible. Look, there's nothing wrong with a good bit of self-critical vigilance. Absolutely not.
Sure.
But I thought the left was all about solidarity. I thought, you know, solidarity was absolutely essential to the left. But the sort of solidarity that I now see, I think the rampant individualism that we have, can destroy the solidarity that people have with each other. And individualism is much more prominent on the left than on the right. That sense about thinking that it's okay to believe in things like home, family, you know, nation, that seems to me to be, until very recently, those things were things that the left would have found entirely unproblematic.
Well, it seems to me that in working class communities, I mean, if you read something like The Road to Wigan Pier by Orwell, the conditions that these people had to live through, conditions that are completely unfathomable to me, I couldn't have survived it. But their sense of community was really the backbone, and the sense of belonging. And so to deny people the right to feel that, or to attack it, is in a sense to attack some of the most underprivileged people in society, is it not?
Belonging's really important. I mean, because of the story I've just told you, you can see why belonging's really important to me. Mm. But I think there's a sort of like a sense that we need other people and that we need to belong, and we need the sort of trust that comes with living alongside people for a decent amount of time. And this isn't an attack on diversity or multiculturalism. I mean, even though that word has been stolen, I think. Mm. But I love living in a diverse society. That's what makes this country great. It's always been a bloody diverse place. Yes. London especially, and I love it for its diversity. But I love it, and I won't be told that I'm not allowed to love the place in which I live and the country that is here, because I do.
This is something that a former guest of mine, Jeff Norcott, the comedian, he does a whole routine about, you know, the way in which the sort of middle class, you might call them woke people, attack working class people for being racist. He's like, we are the most diverse people. We actually live and work and know people of all sorts of ethnicities. It's the privileged white people in their gated communities in their 97% white areas who are berating this imagined enemy that they've concocted.
Well, it's guilt. There may be a guilt aspect to it.
Well, maybe.
I'm fed up with these arguments. I really am. And they bounce off me.
Right.
The idea that a love of community and home and place, really important, the smell of place, the smell of home, all those sorts of things, you know, that is somehow intrinsically suspicious and prejudicial and racist. That's rubbish. It's total rubbish. You know, it's essential to human flourishing. We are social animals, and as social animals, you know, it's not that we just meet on Facebook for 10 minutes or so and then go back to our real lives. We have to be a total part of each other. Rowan Williams, when he did the Today program a few years ago, he was a guest editor of the Today program, and he was asked to record a sound that really summed up for him what he was about. And he went into a Swansea post office and just recorded the sound of people chatting to each other. And just all the videos, but you didn't hear what they were saying. You just heard this sort of general hubby, sort of chatty, 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 chat, chat. And it was the sound of community. It was a beautiful sound of community. And people getting on and knowing each other. And, oh, hello, mate, how are you? I haven't seen you, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, that sort of bubble, that's what I believe in. That's absolutely what I believe in. And if yes. You think that's racist, then you can just bugger off.
Well, I think that's a reasonably good place to end. It's quite a positive message with a hint of a waspish quality to it, which is quite nice. Just to close, because I just want to ask you, because obviously I don't often have a priest on the podcast. So from your perspective, what do we do in 2021? I mean, it's only been a couple of weeks. It already feels like it's a lot worse than 2020. What do we do to solve everything?
To solve everything. I'll have the answer to that, but I'm not telling you. I'm keeping that up my sleeve.
Okay. All right.
I mean, it's actually hard, this, because in the Christian year, you have Advent, and Advent is waiting for hope to arrive, and hope is coming. And
yes.
So all the sermons are about that in the run-up to Christmas. And then he comes, and it's not what you expect.
Yes.
It's still going on. And it's like, this is a really hard time. It feels like a certain degree of, it's not, but it feels like hope disappointed.
Yes.
And it's really easy to get glum at this time, but fear not. I can only answer your question, to be honest. I can't answer it in a sort of way with any great levity, but I can only really answer it in terms of out of my deepest convictions that all will be well. And when Julia of Norwich was sitting in her sort of cell surrounded by the Black Death and manages to come out with all will be well, all will be well, all manner of things will be well, you think to yourself, actually, there's a sort of defiance and hope in Christianity that can't be quashed. And I do have that, albeit sometimes it feels hard to live in that hope. But, I mean, that's where we are.
Giles, thanks very much for coming on the show.
Mate, my friend, nice to see you.
You have been listening to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle and Giles Fraser. If you enjoyed the show, do all the usual stuff, you know, like and subscribe. I've got loads of fascinating guests already booked up this year, so you'd be a total fool to miss that. Make sure that you also pre-order Giles's book. It's called Chosen, Lost and Found Between Christianity and Judaism, which I'm really looking forward to reading myself. So until next time, be good, carpe diem, and all those other vaguely motivational cliches. Bye-bye.